and analysis on demand. This is PID Radio.
Catapult of propaganda.
Alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
We're pleased to welcome back to the guest line here at the Bunker, Peter D. Goodgame, the author of Red Moon Rising and a forthcoming book outlining the connections between the ancient Egyptian god Osiris and the apocalypse. Peter Goodgame, thanks for joining us on PID Radio.
Hello, Derek and Sharon.
Peter, how are you doing out there?
Good. Thanks for calling me up again. I appreciate the chance to talk to you guys.
You know, we had so much feedback, and it was all positive, after we had you on the show regarding Red Moon Rising. And we had to, when we found out what you were up to over there.
Yeah.
Well, when you finally read Part 7 and saw where I was going with this.
Well, that's the thing. I started reading the Giza Discovery series from the interest of history, because the connections that you show between the Sumerian king Enmerkar and the biblical Nimrod was really fascinating. And then tracing his history as an Egyptian going back to his homeland of Sumer and setting up a kingship in Uruk, and then rebuilding the tower, which got God involved on a personal level, was fascinating stuff. But when you posted Part 7 and showed that where you were going was the literal return, well, first of all, identifying Nimrod as Osiris, the Egyptian god, and then showing that there is a strong occult belief,
expectation
in today's world that Osiris is literally going to come back. Like, whoa!
Yeah.
Monkey out of nowhere. So how did you manage to do this?
Yeah, what started you on that trail?
I got started in just being critical of the mainstream interpretation of the seven heads of the dragon, which become the seven heads of the beast, and they're identified very clearly in Revelation 17 as seven kings. But the usual interpretation is referring to them as seven kingdoms and explaining them as being the kingdoms of Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started to view them and tried to figure out who they might be if they were individuals, that's when I was led down this track. And I finally, and it was actually, my first list didn't even have Nimrod on the list. I was completely oblivious. And then an online friend of mine pointed out and said, look, if these are actually individuals, then you need to start with Nimrod. Nimrod would have to be number one.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you think so?
And then from there I realized, just by the statement that the Antichrist is the one who once was, now is not, and yet shall come, I saw that the Antichrist had to be one of the first five that had already passed away at the time of the writing of the book of Revelation. But my first candidate was actually Antiochus Epiphanes.
Sure, because he was set up the abomination of desolation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so I saw, you know, maybe he would come again and have another fulfillment of that prophecy. But only after that is when I started to get into this dying god theme that all the Christian skeptics jump on and offer as proof that there was no historical Jesus, and that the real basis of Christianity can be found in paganism. That's where things started to finally click for me, when I started to trace the historical basis of this dying god figure, and finding out that it leads back to Osiris, who in turn leads to Nimrod. So that's kind of the evolution of my line of investigation so far.
Isn't it amazing when you actually start looking at scripture and you broaden your view to take a look at
you gotta think out of the box.
Well, you know, and you are being very brave, I'll tell you, because there are a lot of Christians that are afraid to peer into darkness.
That's exactly right. Peering into darkness. Don't be scared, you know.
That's something I really feel strongly about. If you are truly a believing Christian, then you have to be able to look at everything and be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have in your faith in Jesus Christ.
Well, you said that the dragon has seven heads.
Yes.
So who are the seven heads? If you're calling them seven kings...
Yes,
the seven
kings of Satan throughout history. I would say that these are seven unique individuals who have had authority over certain kingdoms of the world. I believe these individuals were actually possessed by Satan, and he was able to do his will with them. And in Revelation 13, it says that each of the seven heads has a blasphemous name. So in trying to identify them in history, we can look for characters who show a tendency of blasphemy, of hatred towards God and towards the people of God.
Mm-hmm.
So we've covered number one. Number one is Nimrod. Number one, the list has to begin with Nimrod. Number two on the list, I believe, is probably Pharaoh of Egypt at the time of the Exodus.
Now, that's Ramses. At least that's what...
Well, that's one of the... It's hard to identify exactly who he was. David Rohl pokes holes in the Ramses theory, and I tend to believe with David Rohl that it was before that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, whoever he was, this king definitely wanted to destroy the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, he was used by God to carry out God's will, but he was still obstinate to the extreme, and... he could fit the character of these seven kings, so that's why I place him at number two.
Now, the ten plagues that took place during, we're talking about the Pharaoh of the Exodus, is who you're saying
yes.
is number two. Those ten plagues relate to the gods of the time in some way, don't they?
Yes, this is something I haven't looked into too much, but I'm aware of the idea, and it makes sense to me that these ten plagues are primarily directed at the ten primary Egyptian gods. In other words, they're like repudiating the whole religious system, false religious system that the Egyptians had set up, that was basically the worship of the fallen angels. And it all culminated with the death of the firstborn,
mm-hmm.
the firstborn son of the king. And this is aimed at the monarchy, and whenever we look at the monarchy of ancient Egypt, primary cult associated with the monarchy was the cult of Osiris, who was the firstborn son of Geb, who is viewed as Kronos, who is also viewed as Enki by the Greeks. So it all ties together. Osiris was the son of Satan on a certain level,
mm-hmm.
whether it was literal or not, it's hard to say. But if he was not literal, he was definitely possessed by Satan. But as far as the final plague, Pharaoh's son died. And it's interesting that it's like a repudiation of the cult of Osiris, and it was through this act that the nation of Israel was created,
mm-hmm.
and was formed and was able to become free and leave Egypt and take possession of the promised land. And it was through Israel that the true Messiah came forth. So we have this kind of interplay here between the two messiahs right at the beginning of the creation of Israel.
That's amazing, because that gives such a new spin to it, to think, again, as you're saying, that these are kings who existed and were literally taken over by Satan.
Yes, yes. Now, the third king on the list, we go to Sennacherib of Assyria. He really helped to build up the Assyrian Empire. One of his conquests was Babylon, and he became known as the King of Babylon. He crowned himself the king of Babylon, and we have his story in Isaiah 37, and then there's a description of him in Isaiah chapter 14. This description of him begins talking about Sennacherib himself, the king of Babylon, and then it seamlessly transitions into a description that can only apply to Satan, when it talks about how you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn, you've been cast down to the earth. And then it ends with Satan, proclaiming his fantasy, I will ascend above the tops of the clouds, I will make myself like the Most High. So I think this transition here can only be understood if we realize that Satan and Sennacherib, this king of Babylon, were at one time united in the same person. In other words, Sennacherib himself was possessed by Satan. And yes, his story, his relationship with Israel was, you know, he went up, I think it was King Hezekiah, and Hezekiah turned to the Lord in prayer and asked to be saved. And then Sennacherib's army was warned off, saying, you guys get out of here. You do not have, God's not going to allow you to destroy this people. And they stayed, and they kept blaspheming God. And during that night, the angel of the Lord came and slaughtered over 100,000 of them.
So, yes, Sennacherib, and then he went back home, and he basically was killed by his own family, wasn't he?
Oh, that's right. He was killed in the temple of his god, Nisroch, who scholars believe that they equate Nisroch with the god Ninurta, who was a deification of Nimrod, one of the early deifications. Ninurta and Ninurta, their myths are very, very closely the same. And it's interesting that the primary temple of Ninurta was set up in the holy city of Nippur. It was a holy city to the Sumerians. Originally, it was the holy city of the god Enlil.
Enlil.
Oh, yeah.
Who many people equate to
Yahweh.
To Jehovah.
Yeah.
So it's like that's how the pantheon was taken over when the deification of Nimrod kicked in a lot of his position.
Oh,
okay.
My goodness. Okay, so we have Nimrod, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, and Sennacherib.
The next one is very similar to the king of Babylon. This is the king of Tyre, who is described in Ezekiel chapter 28. We have the very same thing, and the text begins with the characterizations that can only refer to a human being, and then it talks about a being who can only be identified as Lucifer. When it talks about you were the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden. You were anointed as a guardian cherub. And then it talks about you were blameless until wickedness was found in you. You're filled with violence. You sinned. I drove you in disgrace from the Mount of God. I expelled you from among the fiery stones. And that can only be a description of Lucifer. And again, we find Satan and this king of Tyre united in one body. So that would be number four.
Mm-hmm.
Now, number five has to be Antiochus Epiphanes, the fourth.
Right. I'm sure a lot of people would agree with you.
Yes,
he has to be on the list somewhere.
He's very well known as a persecutor of the Jews. He tried to destroy Judaism by taking over the temple, installing his own high priest, I believe setting up a statue of Zeus, and then sacrificing a pig upon the altar of God to Zeus. So, yes, very blasphemous. He was also very full of himself. If you look at the Greek historical records of this figure, he was really into ceremony and he was a very very spiritually minded person, except very wicked.
Yeah, there can't be any question there. In fact, his was the original abomination of desolation.
That's right. That's right. And again, his description is given in Daniel chapter 11. Near the end of the chapter, we have another seamless transition where it's talking about the historical Antiochus,
mm-hmm.
and then it transitions into a description of the end times Antichrist. So,
mm-hmm.
This is one of the reasons why I looked at Antiochus as a possible candidate
exactly.
for the Antichrist
yeah.
before my eyes were opened. But I think all of these kings are all, the common denominator is Satan, which is why the prophets, you know, were divinely, they were allowed to, you know, have those accounts transition in there seamlessly,
mm-hmm.
going from the historical Antiochus to the Antichrist himself.
Sure, and of course the other connection is Jesus during the Olivet Discourse talking about warning future generations. When you see the abomination of desolation,
yes.
run for the hills.
Run.
Yeah, well, then they had an image to look back to. You know, to see, you know, what did Jesus mean? Well, look at the original abomination of desolation. It was a statue erected in the temple.
Right.
This is the same kind of thing mentioned by Paul in 2 Thessalonians and in the book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, yeah, and in Revelation it says that the false prophet is
the image of the beast.
Image, exactly.
Yep.
That's really interesting because that could be, you know, the bringing out of the body or a creation of a full-sized image to represent the body of Osiris when it's finally discovered at the necropolis at Giza.
Yes. Mm. Very possible.
Okay
now that those are the first five. Nimrod,
the angel says
Pharaoh,
five were.
Yeah, Nimrod, Pharaoh of Egypt, Sennacherib, the king of Babylon, and the king of Tyre, and then Antiochus Epiphanes.
Right.
And according to Revelation 17, when he went through the seven heads, he said five have been.
Mm-hmm.
One is yet to come, and then there will be an eighth.
And this is speaking to John in, what, 90 AD or so?
Yes, or perhaps 66 AD, as we'll get to, because I think that the one that, when he says one is, that meant that whenever John was writing down, receiving this message, there was a king that was ruling at that time who was Satan incarnate, mm-hmm. essentially, by being possessed by Satan. And I look to evidence that says that the book of Revelation was written down very early, in the 60s A.D., and there's a couple of different things that support this. Rather than having it happen in 90 A.D., which is the modern scholars really kind of accept the later date.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the church father Clement of Alexandria, he said that the canon had been completed under Nero's reign. There's another list of texts, the Muratorian Canon. It has John completing Revelation before Paul had written to the seven churches, which was finished up in 67 or 68 A.D.
Hmm.
The church father Tertullian placed John's banishment to Patmos at the same time as Peter and Paul's martyrdom. So if we look at an early, possible early date, we're looking at Nero. We're looking at the Emperor Nero Caesar,
hmm.
who is also very well known as a persecutor of early Christians.
Oh, yes.
And then his character, just the whole life history of this character is just filled with wickedness and deceit and pride and boy, it would make a great HBO movie, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because he every sin possible this guy commits, and then he tops it all off by burning Christians to light his gardens.
Yeah.
So,
putting them in wax shirts so that they burn nice and basically turning them into human tiki torches.
Yes, yes. So that's who I would say we need to look at as possibly being the sixth of the seven heads of Satan.
Now who existed. I was going to say the preterists would probably agree with you, at least insofar as your dating of the Book of Revelation.
That's the drawback to taking the early view, yes, because they believe that, the Book of Revelation was fulfilled in 70 A.D.,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a completely absurd
mm-hmm. Yeah,
conclusion to come to. But
if that lets them sleep at night, well.
Yep.
Now, but if this was written at a later date, who would have been the emperor around 90? Was that Diocletian?
Diocletian or Domitian or one of those guys, a case can be made for them, but not as good. Nero just begs to be included on the list.
He does, sure. Doesn't he? Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a weird dude.
Now, there are some words said about the seventh king in Revelation chapter 17. When the explanation offered, the angel simply tells John that the seven heads of the beast are seven kings. Five have fallen. One is. The other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes on to say the beast, which was and is not, is himself an eighth and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. So what he's saying is that one of these satanic kings would precede the coming of the Antichrist. And I believe that if we looked over history from today back until the time of Nero, throughout this whole, you know, when Christianity dominated, you know, the Western world, I think there's only one person that stands out as having these same characteristics of a satanically possessed individual who was blasphemous against God and who tried to persecute God's people, and I think that individual has to be Adolf Hitler.
That would fit.
You know, that would fit. And I'm betting that a lot of listeners out there are going, what? Never thought he'd be on that head.
A biblical prophecy identifying a guy who lived within the lifetimes of people that we know.
Yeah.
That's hitting pretty close to home.
Yeah, but you know what? Yes. He was so into the occult.
The Nazi Party, it should be said, was more of a cult than a political party. It truly was.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, we're going to delve into that in future shows on PID Radio.
Now this identification of Hitler as the seventh king, I also apply that to the first seal. In other words, in my timeline, I think that the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse are like birth pangs of the apocalypse. I think they occur, you know, prior to the seven-year tribulation. I think the first seal can apply to Hitler because it says that I looked and behold a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. So again, it's like Adolf Hitler only came to power for the purpose of conquest.
Mm-hmm.
And like Revelation 17 says, his reign was pretty short.
You know, but I can see the logic of that, because if the, you know, because of what the angel said, five are dead. One is talking to John in present time. One is, and one will come, and then the eighth will be.
Yes.
You know, if we're going to assume that the future that is being shown to John on Patmos in the Book of Revelation is starting off with the end times, then it would only make sense that would be, you know, the next king, the next head.
Right. It would be the next
would be
king.
The start of it all.
Prophetic fulfillment, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Makes you wonder, though, going through history, whether people living in the 5th or 6th century thought that this would be the 6th century, whether Genghis Khan, for example, or Attila the Hun,
writer.
Yeah.
Right. It was the 7th king.
Right.
And the rider on the white
horse.
They were
definitely perceived as antichrists, as threats to Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Well, Napoleon, I think, was also perceived that way.
By the Protestants, but not by the Catholics, because he was crowned by the Pope, and he took the crown out of the Pope's hands and put it on his own head.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. But I think at the time, because his name is so close to Apollyon.
True.
They thought that he might be that very leader.
Right. But, of course, Adolf Hitler had a particular desire to eliminate the Jewish race, the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
From
as well as
the
religion of Christianity. He hated it with a passion.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And while critics may point to the fact that the majority of the people in the Nazi Party were baptized Roman Catholics and used that to assault Christianity, the fact is that you know people by their fruits, and if they're not acting like Christians, then they're not.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so then we're back to the eighth king, the one who is to come.
Yes, and that is the one who is to come is the one who started it all, and it can only be Nimrod. And as we talked on Saturday night, the occult world has this expectation that the dying god of paganism will rise again.
Now, something that that you pointed out in your study that I really found fascinating was the connections between the number 70 and 72 and how they apply to both Nimrod and Osiris. Can you talk about that?
This is very important. When Plutarch, who was a Greek historian, he was also the high priest of Apollo at Delphi, when he first wrote down the myth of Isis and Osiris in literary form, he said that when Osiris was killed, he was killed by his brother Set in cooperation with 72 other conspirators. And again, this ties in directly with the understanding that when the nations were divided right after the time of Nimrod, that it was done according to the number of the sons of God, which was 70, and according to the number of nations on the Table of Nations list, which was 70. And then it changes into 72 simply for astrological reasons, like I mentioned, in that 72 is exactly a fifth of 360, which is, of course, the circle of the zodiac.
Right.
So 72 and 70 are really kind of equated. Now, we also see this thing in the Gospel of Luke when Jesus sends out, according to the different versions, one version says he sends out 70 disciples, one version says he sends out 72. Anyway, their purpose is to declare the coming of the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come back to Jesus and they say that, Lord, even the demons have submitted to us in your name, that's when Jesus says, I have seen Satan fall like lightning from heaven. In other words, Satan was talking about the end of Satan's kingdom on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of an echo of Isaiah 14.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. Now, so that is really one of the firmest connections between Osiris and Nimrod. They go very deeper than that, and I wish I had more time to explore that. But people can go to my online texts, and I go way deep into that.
Okay, how does Nimrod, he's the one who built the Tower of Babel? Is that correct?
Yes.
also, how do you get Nimrod into Egypt?
This is a good question. Nimrod was a descendant of was a son of Cush. David Roll approaches this by saying that that it was a, like the inner circle, the inner cult that followed Nimrod after the fall of his kingdom. He was brought into Egypt. That his followers came into Egypt and they conquered it. The other view I have that I'm really strongly considering is that maybe the Egyptians were right. Maybe Osiris's point of origin was Egypt, because Cush, even according to the Sumerians, the father of Enmerkar, it said he left by the sea and went up into the mountains, and the land of Cush is the land south of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's this whole other thing about trying to identify Nimrod as perhaps one of the early Egyptian kings, and there's a lot of tantalizing information there, because on one hand, one of the major kings early in their king list is this guy by the name of Narmer, King Narmer, and the Narmer Palette is a very important artifact that has been found. Again, we got Enmerkar, Nimrod, Narmer. It all seems to correlate
exactly,
together.
Exactly, because they didn't have vowels back then.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much constant, so you get this NMR repeating.
Yeah. So perhaps Nimrod, his point of origin was Egypt, and then when he died, his body was brought back, and eventually, you know, a few hundred years later, that's when the religion revolving around him was created, and that's when the Giza necropolis was built according to the layout of the constellation Orion.
That makes a lot of sense. So Cush, who was the son of Ham, grandson of Noah,
mm-hmm.
founds his kingdom in what is now Ethiopia.
Yep.
Nimrod founds the first, or he, now Narmer, was he in the first dynasty or was he pre-dynastic?
Well, he was pre-dynastic, and I think there's a debate as to where he fits in. But then there's another king, I think it's the second or third on the list, who also fits the possibility of perhaps being Nimrod. It's really hard to know exactly, though. But there's definitely tantalizing hints there.
Mm-hmm. So the working theory is that Nimrod is an early king, if not the first king of Egypt, and that he goes forth, according to the myth of Osiris, to bring civilization to the world.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to Mesopotamia, returns back to the roots of where the civilization began, and sets up his kingdom at the town at the city of Uruk, U-R-U-K.
Right, that was his first his political capital, and then his spiritual capital was in the city of Eridu, and that's where he started to build the Tower of Babel.
Right, and the Tower of Babel, as we discussed on Saturday night, was essentially a reconstruction of the pre-flood temple devoted to Enki, or Satan.
Yes, Enki was his cult headquarters from the very beginning, going back to his connections with Cain and with the dynasty of Cain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this also goes into some of the early history involved in Freemasonry, because according to the Masons, and now we have to look at this through the perspective of Gnostic Christians, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Gnostic Christians say that they believe in Christ, but they believe that Christ was a manifestation of the serpent from the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Gnostics, the God of the Old Testament was evil, and the serpent was good.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the heroes in the Old Testament that we would perceive as heroes become villains. All of the villains become heroes.
Back to that mirror.
Absolutely.
That mirror darkly.
So according to one of these, I think it dates like to the 1400s, one of these myths tells the tale of just before the flood, the final descendants of the line of Cain inscribe all their knowledge on two pillars and they bury it. After the flood, guess who comes back and finds those pillars and digs them up? It's Nimrod, son of Cush.
And the two pillars correspond to the two pillars that you find at every Masonic lodge.
Yes,
yeah.
Jachin and Boaz or whatever.
Oh, okay.
And then they relate them to the holy temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem.
Aren't those same two pillars on the temple?
Yes, but the Hebrew understanding of them is much different than the Gnostic, we can safely say.
Okay. That's really interesting, though.
And then we also find out that in Freemasonry, Hiram Abiff, right now the main myth, main ritual, is the story of Hiram Abiff, who was killed while he's building the temple of God in Jerusalem under King Solomon. Mm-hmm. And Hiram Abiff was given to Solomon by the king of Tyre.
Right.
And according to this myth, while he's building it, Hiram is murdered by three ruffians, three of his apprentice carpenters. And that's the foundation. That's where the lost wisdom disappeared. And according to them, he was murdered before he had completed the temple. But then, if we go back to what all the Masonic historians say, and they explain that Hiram Abiff is a representation of Osiris, who is Nimrod, we can plainly see that in the historical context, the Freemasons, the unfinished building that they're talking about, is not the Temple of Jerusalem. It's actually the Tower of Babel.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And again, that ties back to the symbol applied to the 33rd degree Freemasons,
uh-huh,
being the double-headed eagle of Lagash, the symbol of Ningirsu, the deified Nimrod.
Another deified Nimrod, exactly.
You know what? I just recently read an article. Was it Armenia where they found the archaeological evidence,
yes,
of Nimrod?
Yes.
There are ruins up there that have tablets, or maybe it's a stele.
Yeah.
But it shows an inscription saying that the king who was over that area in Armenia was ordered by Nimrod to send lots of
the Lord of Errata.
Yeah, exactly. The Lord of Errata.
This equates exactly with the Lord of Errata epic, yes.
Have you seen that?
I have not. I'd be interested in checking it out.
I'll see if I can find it and send it to you.
Yeah,
yeah, it was really interesting stuff, and again, it ties in with what we're talking about here to provide the historic underpinnings for what we see in the Bible and what we see preserved as this Gnostic myth.
I found it because I was looking up Stonehenge, oddly enough, and there is a very similar structure in Armenia, in that area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I got onto that, I found this article about the Nimrod tablet.
Well, according to the Egyptians, Osiris conquered the entire civilized world.
Well, what's extremely interesting about this story is that this same king claimed that he killed Nimrod. Now, if he was one of 72.
Yeah.
But he claimed he had the head.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's another piece of the puzzle as we
killed with
see
the sword.
Yeah.
Again, going back to this idea that he was, that his head was cut off with a sword.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then we get Nimrod or Osiris, who's returned to Mesopotamia and set up a kingdom at Uruk, maybe leaving a brother in charge of his Egyptian base while he's away, conquering the civilized world, bringing civilization,
yes,
to the Fertile Crescent.
Perhaps. You're equating the brother with Set.
With Set, yeah.
I'm not sure how much of this we can take as literal and historical. You know, it's hard to draw the line. Somewhere we got to draw the line as far as what is myth and what is actually history.
Sure.
But perhaps the historical Set could also be identified.
Yeah, possibly. But we, from a historical standpoint, as you mentioned Saturday night, archaeologists have located the ruins of a great ziggurat at Eridu,
yes,
with levels that go
completely
back below the silt level that they identify with the Great Flood,
mm-hmm,
dating all the way back to the very earliest stages of human civilization, you know, going back about 6,000 years, mm-hmm, or more,
yes,
at Eridu.
It falls right in line with this
theory that we're working out here.
And with the Sumerian texts themselves, who say that Eridu was the first city ever built, and then this equates also with the Book of Genesis. It says that Cain built the first city, named after his son Enoch, mm-hmm, and the next son, and Enoch's son was Irad. Mm-hmm. So the name eventually came to be associated with the grandson of Enoch, Irad, and Eridu.
Yeah.
And the root word of that is to descend.
Mm-hmm. So then, after Nimrod's death, now Nimrod's death, then you would equate to the to God's
Nimrod's death was
to,
yes,
stop the temple.
Yes, yes. Like I said before, the situation had reached an impasse. God needed to change the situation globally, and what he did is he came to an agreement with this fallen angelic faction. He met with them in the council, and they all agreed that Nimrod would be put to death. His division, his empire, would be divided up and given over into the hands of these angels. So all the tribes of the nation of the world were divided up. They were all given different languages, and each one, whether on a one-to-one basis or collectively, anyway, these 70 or 72 fallen sons of God inherited authority over the nations of the world.
And that's who the ancient Hebrews remember as the pantheon of the neighbors,
right.
The ancient Hebrews,
right.
Like Molech,
right.
And Chemosh and Dagon. And
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, okay.
And then throughout the Old Testament, it speaks about, the interesting thing is the Israelites never engaged in any offensive wars. They had one big battle at the beginning to take over the land that had been promised to them. And also Mike Kaiser goes into this and talks about when Abraham received this promise, it was actually done in a divine council setting. In other words, Abraham appeared as a human being in the council of the gods.
Really?
And God said, I'm giving you this land. This is the stairway to heaven. I don't know if you've read this about that Mike has written, but then if you go into extra-biblical texts and Kabbalistic texts, they say that the rungs on the ladder were numbered either as 72, in other words, there's one angel of this group on each rung, or else 36, and two ladders on each rung, one angel going up, two angels on each rung, one angel going up, and one angel coming down.
Yeah, just like Jacob.
So okay. I'm sorry. The story was Jacob. Jacob's ladder.
Yeah.
I said Abraham. Yes.
Yeah.
You're right. It's Jacob. When God reiterated the promise to Jacob,
right, okay,
that this land was his. In other words, all the angels knew that that was God's land and that was going to be for his people.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, when Jacob's family went down into Egypt, that's when the giants came in and they said, you know, they're directly opposing the will of God coming in and trying to take over this land. That's why God had to engage, had to, you know, have this conquest, this very bloody conquest, to bring Israel back into their own land.
Yeah, and Mike has done an excellent study, as we mentioned on Saturday night, on Joshua's conquest and how, when you map it out, it follows the territories that were identified with the giants.
Yes,
he basically
absolutely
was on a conquest of the tribes of giants,
mm-hmm,
that had moved into Canaan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting stuff, and it's really exciting to see how this dovetails with what we know of history from archaeology. And we look forward to discussing this even further.
Well, I'd like to show you some stuff from this Masonic historian, Manly P. Hall. He's got some really amazing stuff equating, going into Hiram Abiff, going into his belief that Osiris would be resurrected again.
Oh, that really is interesting, especially since supposedly Zahi Hawass is a Freemason.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Our guest is, again, Peter Goodgame, the author of Red Moon Rising, and a forthcoming book that we can't wait to see, dealing with the Giza discovery and the return of the Antichrist.
I know. And now, you said that you were going to give us some information from a guy who wrote as a Freemason regarding the Osiris connection.
Yes, his name is Manly P. Hall. He is a high-level Freemason. When he was, I think, 25 or 26 years old, he wrote his magnum opus called The Secret Teachings of All Ages, and this was in the late 1920s. This was right around the time that Edgar Cayce was coming into popularity and doing a lot of his channeled messages and healing work, which kind of masked the sinister source of you know, his messages. But Manly P. Hall is a very interesting character, and in the last part we talked about the connection between in Freemasonry between Hiram Abiff and Osiris,
mm-hmm,
and also how their original histories before the model of their myth was the Temple of Jerusalem. It was before that. It was actually the story of Nimrod. And so it's like we can triangulate and see that it's Hiram Abiff, Nimrod, Osiris. They all link up. Let me just read this quote from Manly P. Hall, when he just states clearly that Preston, Gould, Mackey, Oliver, and Albert Pike, in fact, nearly every great historian of Freemasonry, have all admitted the possibility of the modern society being connected, indirectly at least, with the ancient mysteries. And their descriptions of the modern society are prefaced by excerpts from ancient writings descriptive of primitive ceremonials. These eminent Masonic scholars have all recognized in the legend of Hiram Abiff an adaptation of the Osiris myth. nor do they deny that the major part of the symbolism of the craft is derived from the pagan institutions of antiquity, when the gods were venerated in secret places with strange figures and appropriate rituals. So that's what Freemasonry is. It is the worship of the ancient gods.
You know, that's really interesting to read that, or have you read that, because the Blue Lodge guys will tell you
that this,
you know,
doesn't
all
exist.
Day long, that is not true.
Yeah, or, yeah. And then if you dig into it a little bit, they say that it's okay. It still doesn't conflict with Christianity. You're free to practice Christianity. And actually, Christianity ties right in, because Jesus was the first Freemason, or was one of the Freemasons.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, as far as Freemasons are concerned.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. No, I
That's
know you don't believe
you.
That. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting how it's been hidden from sight from most people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as Sharon pointed out, even the guys that are in the Blue Lodge, the first, second, third mm-hmm. level Freemasons, don't know that this is what it's all about.
Oh, probably. I would venture to say that almost every adult male in the church that I grew up in was a Mason.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It, and when you begin to understand what the symbolism of the higher level, well, at any level really, but especially the higher level Masons, what the implications are, that as a Christian, you,
mm-hmm.
it just, there's no way you can really participate.
Well, yeah, on the internet you can find stories of people who've been raised to the 33rd degree, and then who, after that, you know, hello, it hit them finally that what they were involved in was completely anti-Christian in nature.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Most of the guys who are third, below the third level, they just see it as, a service organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Anyway,
I'm not downplaying it at all. I'm just saying that they are hiding it from their own people.
Right, right, definitely. Well, Albert Pike said that there are different levels to the mystery, and, mm-hmm. and the deception is a very key component of the craft, so that's definitely true. Now, the next thing I have is really goes into this connection between Hiram Abiff and the expectation that he will rise again. And just remember, keep in mind that Hiram Abiff, we're talking about the ancient god Osiris.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I have is from a book called The Lost Keys of Freemasonry that was written by Manly P. Hall. I'm not sure exactly when the date was, but it's interesting. This is a selection just from, it's a story of Hiram Abiff. Now, he was a master builder who helped to build the temple in Jerusalem, supposedly, according to the story. And before the temple is completed, three of his own builders rise up and kill him. Now, let me just begin. I have just a few selections to read. Turning upon their maker and striking him with his own tools given him by God out of heaven, they left their grandmaster dying in the midst of his labors, broken and crushed by the threefold powers of cosmic night. So then the Hiram Abiff, the master mason, lays there bleeding, and he cries out to God, or his God, and he begins by saying, "O master of workmen, great architect of the universe, my labors are not finished. Why must they always remain undone? I have not completed the thing for which thou hast sent me unto being, for my very creations have turned against me, and the tools thou gavest me have destroyed me." And then he ends his prayer by saying, "In thy name, Father, I have labored, and in thy cause I die, a faithful builder." So then it says, the master fell back, his upturned face sweet in the last repose of death, and the light rays no longer pouring from him. The gray clouds gathered closer as though to form a winding sheet around the body of their murdered master. Suddenly, the heavens opened again, and the shaft of light bathed the form of Hiram in a glory celestial. Again, the voice spoke from the heavens where the great king sat upon the clouds of creation. Now listen to what the great architect of the universe says. He says, "He is not dead. He is asleep. Who will awaken him? His labors are not done, and in death he guards the sacred relics more closely than ever." And he goes on, "But he must remain asleep until these three who have slain him shall bring him back to life. For every wrong must be righted, and the slayers of my house, the destroyers of my temple, must labor in the place of their builder until they raise their master from the dead." And then the three murderers fall to their knees, and they cry out. They say, "O God, great is our sin, for we have slain our grandmaster Hiram Abiff. Just is thy punishment, and as we have slain him, we now dedicate our lives to his resurrection. The first was our human weakness, the second our sacred duty." And then they have a conversation with the great architect of the universe, and it ends when when their God says to the three, "This eternal quest is yours until ye have found your builder, until the cup giveth up its secret, until the grave giveth up its ghosts. No more shall I speak until ye have found and raised my beloved son, and have listened to the words of my messenger, and with him as your guide, have finished the temple which I shall then inhabit." Amen. So it ends with a call to finish the building of the temple, and it's talking about the temple in Jerusalem. Now there's a whole other series of topics here involved with the Masonic expectation or the Masonic desire to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, the temple of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where Hiram Abiff ended. He is expected to be resurrected, and the temple is expected to be rebuilt. So we have both the a reference to the end times temple, which the Apostle Paul said will be inhabited by the Antichrist, and we also have a reference to the actual resurrection of the Antichrist at the time of the end.
Interesting that would explain an awful lot of the political wheeling and dealing that's going on in Jerusalem right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And Barry Kamish is a friend of mine. I archive a lot of his writings. He's a journalist based out of Israel,
mm-hmm.
and right now he's really covering in detail the connections between the Vatican and the State of Israel, especially concerning the holy places of Jerusalem, and how the Vatican wants to have control over those, and how they also want, there's a faction within Israeli politics that wants to turn over some of their most sacred sites to international authority. In other words, over to the UN or whoever. They want to willingly give it up and turn it over into the hands of the globalists.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of influence are the Masons having in this movement to turn over land in Jerusalem?
It's hard to say, but the Masons are very big in Israel. The mayor of Jerusalem, Teddy Kollek, was one of he's a former mayor, but he was one of the main head Masons in Jerusalem. There were even Masonic ceremonies in the Solomon's Grotto, I believe, underneath the Temple Mount.
Really?
Yeah, around the time of just before the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. And then if you look at, for instance, the Israeli Supreme Court is just permeated with pyramids and, obelisks and, steps that go up and down that are 33 steps, 33 levels. The Eye of Horus, all these things. It's a total Masonic thing, which really kind of makes sense because the whole building was, the whole layout of the architecture was funded by the Rothschilds.
Yeah.
Oh,
in fact,
yeah, that's right.
We put a link on one of our previous shows, and I forgot who we were interviewing regarding that, but I think it was Eric John Phelps we were talking with about the Masonic influence in Jerusalem, and we put a link to a great article by Jerry Golden with pictures.
Yes. Yes, that
shows.
That's where I got my information as well.
Clearly, yes, definitely. Barry Kamish and Jerry Golden are people that we need to talk to because it's almost stunning when you look at it. I mean, it's one thing to hear about this stuff and kind of go, yeah, right,
right.
But when you see the pictures and see how clearly the symbolism is displayed, how obvious it is, and when you begin to understand what it signifies, you see that this isn't just fooling around. This isn't people just thinking that these are neat designs to put on their buildings.
Yeah.
There is a spiritual dimension to this that is at work. And as Christians, we either believe in the supernatural world or we're not really believing everything that's written in between the covers of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Wow.
Well, we're coming back to Zahi Hawa. Because we watched a show either earlier today or yesterday, and he was talking about the symbols that the Egyptians put on in the tombs. And he was saying that to them it's more than writing.
Yeah.
It's literally, there's a spiritual essence.
It's like a spell,
Yeah.
It's magic to them, definitely.
Yeah.
Now, I have, if we have time, I have a couple of more selections.
Please.
I'd like to read, again, from Manly P. Hall. This comes from his book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, and it comes from his section where he talks about the initiation of the pyramid and the pyramid mysteries. And this section here begins by him saying, he refers to a scholar who calls the Great Pyramid the House of the Hidden Places. Such indeed it was, for it represented the inner sanctum of pre-Egyptian wisdom. And then he equates Hermes to the pyramid. Relating Hermes to the pyramid emphasizes anew the fact that it was in reality the supreme temple of the invisible and supreme deity. The Great Pyramid was not a lighthouse, an observatory, or a tomb, but the first temple of the mysteries, the first structure erected as a repository for those secret truths which are the certain foundation of all arts and sciences. It was the perfect emblem of the microcosm and the macrocosm, and according to the secret teachings, the tomb of Osiris, the black god of the Nile. And then he goes on to talk about the initiation. He says, through the mystic passageways and chambers of the Great Pyramid, past the illumined of antiquity, they entered its portals as men, they came forth as gods. It was the place of the second birth, the womb of the mysteries, and wisdom dwelt in it as God dwells in the hearts of men. And then he goes on to talk about it. There's this great initiate, illustrious one, who lives there and who does these initiations for these people. Then he talks, who was the master dwelling in the mighty pyramid, the many rooms of which signify the worlds in space, the master whom none might behold save those who had been, quote-unquote, born again. And he goes on, that the technique of the mysteries was unfolded by the master of the secret house. The power to know his guardian spirit was revealed to the new initiate. The method of disentangling his material body from his divine vehicle was explained, and to consummate the magnum opus, there was revealed the divine name, which is very important. Both of these things, the divine name and the power to know your guardian spirit. One of the big transitions in the work of Aleister Crowley was when he came across this occult material that gave him the method by which to connect with his holy guardian angel.
I'm glad you...
Which he referred to as his demon, Iwas, who channeled through him his Book of the Law.
I'm glad you brought up Aleister Crowley, because I've been wondering since we talked on Saturday night about Crowley's belief that we were about to enter the age of Horus.
Right, right.
And how this all connected.
Yes, we can get into that. Let me just finish up here. This is going to wind up in a big way here.
Okay,
Manly P. Hall goes on, in the king's chamber was enacted the drama of the second death. Here the candidate, after being crucified upon the cross of the solstices and the equinoxes, was buried in the great coffer. So he's saying that's how this empty coffin in the king's chamber was used. And then he says, in one sense, the Great Pyramid may be likened to a gate through which the ancient priests permitted a few to pass toward the attainment of individual completion. And this goes to modern day, like New Age guys, especially this whole collection of British guys who really think that the Egyptians had discovered the scientific mystery of immortality. In other words, that there's an actual science involved, that anybody can access it. But the question that I have is, if it was a science, if it was discovered, why do they keep it secret? Why don't they let everybody have immortality?
Yeah.
Well, it's a matter of control, you know. I mean, we could make America mostly energy independent by, you know, taking the oil from the North Slope, but the reason we're slugging it out in the Middle East is so we can keep everybody else from getting theirs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Same deal.
Now this winds up right now with an interesting reference here. He goes on, the great theological Tower of Babel, with its confusion of tongues, was built of bricks of mud and a mortar of slime. Out of the cold ashes of lifeless creeds, however, shall rise, phoenix-like, the ancient mysteries. No other institution has so completely satisfied the religious aspirations of humanity. For since the destructions of the mysteries, there has never been a religious code to which Plato could have subscribed. And here's the big finish, the last paragraph. He begins by saying, the dying god shall rise again. The secret room in the house of the hidden places shall be rediscovered. The pyramid again shall stand as the ideal emblem of solidarity, inspiration, aspiration, resurrection, and regeneration. As the passing sands of time bury civilization upon civilization beneath their weight, the pyramid shall remain as a visible covenant between eternal wisdom and the world. The time may yet come when the chants of the illumined shall be heard once more in its ancient passageways, and the master of the hidden house shall await in a silent place for the coming of that man who, casting aside the fallacies of dogma and tenet, seeks simply truth and will be satisfied with neither substitute nor counterfeit. And that's the end.
Interesting.
What was the book again that was from?
This is called The Secret Teachings of All Ages, and it was first produced, a print run of 500 in the late 20s. It was never published in a mass market paperback form until 2003.
Really?
That's right.
Hmm.
How interesting, the timing. And it would certainly seem to...
Well, that sums it up. When Manly P. Hall says very clearly, the dying god shall rise again, the hidden chamber will be found in the Great Pyramid. I had, when I read this, the first time I read this, I had to put the book down and pace around for about an hour just to absorb.
Well, you know, Casey was saying essentially the same thing.
Yes, yes. He came about the same time. And then after Edgar Casey, there's this the appearance of this unique group of spirit entities who started channeling through the circle of this guy named Andre Puharich.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Lavenda gets into this a little bit in his trilogy that's currently out there.
Yes,
but,
which we're working on right now. And by the way, we're going to have Peter Lavenda as a guest here in the very near future.
That would be awesome, yeah. And now another group that goes a little more detail into them, another group of authors, it's Lynn Pickman and Clive Prince and their book, The Stargate Conspiracy, except you gotta be careful about that one because the most recent book published by Lynn Pickman is a book on Lucifer, and I think the subtitle is Evil Angel or The Answer to Life Itself or something like that.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Read with discernment. Chew meat, spit out the bones.
Exactly.
Well, I think it's really interesting, too, that we're entering, you know, they've been heralding the age of Aquarius now for 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we're entering into that as we, you know, the procession goes around. Well, the age of the water bearer, you know, to the New Agers represents that this water bearer is pouring out knowledge during the age of Aquarius.
Yep.
And so what we're looking for, or what we're seeing, is a group of people who are looking for the literal resurrection of a man whom they believe to be a god, Nimrod, Enmerkar, Osiris.
Mm-hmm.
And in him will be placed their hopes for the beginning of a new age. They will see in him the Messiah.
Yes,
he will
set the example, and everybody will believe in him as their key to eternal life.
You know, this is going to be, you got to get this book done because I know everybody listening to this podcast, they're all sitting there, okay, we're going to get email. When is it coming out? Can I buy it now? Can I pre-order it?
I know.
Yeah. So.
Well, and Peter, we have to, you know, commend you because many authors would be very jealous of their manuscript, and you have very generously put the working draft of this manuscript on your website under the Giza conspiracy title, the Giza Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I gotta make, if I'm really truly onto something, I need to post, you know, what I discover immediately before they take me out. So, keep me in your prayers.
We certainly
do.
We
always do keep you in our prayers.
And we certainly recommend that people hearing this who are interested in learning more, go to your site and read the manuscript that's available there. It may not be the final form of the book as the book comes out, but...
Well, I still need to finish the online manuscript, and then I plan to put it all in a PDF, and then for a price, people will be able to download the entire PDF. I'll still offer the online version where people can read it for free, but for offline use, I plan to offer the complete study.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so,
great.
So, but I got a lot more to write, though, before even that is done, and then I need to begin repackaging it and cleaning it up into the form of a manuscript.
That's the fun part.
Yes.
You well, Peter, good game.
Besides with me, don't you? Yes,
we do.
We do.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for spending your time with us and going through this point by point and showing us the connections between the ancient mysteries and the modern occult belief in the return of the dying god Osiris, Nimrod, Enmerkar, and the role that he's going to play in the apocalypse.
That's right. And, of course, we know that the true return of the true dying god, Jesus Christ, that's coming up soon, too.
Yeah, but the difference there is that we've got the dying and rising god.
Amen.
Yeah, because he is alive now.
Amen.
That's right.
He is indeed.
That's right.
Peter Goodgame, thank you for being our guest on PID Radio.
Thanks, you guys. Thank you very much.
God bless, Peter. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
News and analysis on demand. This is PID Radio.
They're coming from the darkness. Over 6,000 years ago, the citizens of Mesopotamia encountered them.
Down through time, tens of thousands of people on every continent of the world have etched their likeness on the walls of caves, chiseled statues of them from solid stone, and prayed prayers to their highest gods to be delivered from them.
But prophecy says they will return, and at a time when Babylon, modern Iraq, and Iran is invaded and destroyed. This spring, exclusively from RaidersNewsUpdate.com, we'll tell you what you need to know about them. In the book-length ebook, Stargates, Ancient Rituals, and Those Invited Through the Portal.
In the 14th century, the Black Death killed nearly one-third the population of Europe. In 1918, the Spanish flu killed as many as 100 million people. The next great plague may already be spreading. Inspired by today's headlines, it's the Armageddon Strain, the explosive new thriller from Sharon K. Gilbert. At a laboratory somewhere in the desert southwest, a secretive group has created a deadly virus for a single purpose, to eliminate 90% of human life. Standing in their way is Dr. Maggie Taylor, a woman broken by grief and alcohol, who must somehow find the strength to unravel the mystery of her father's death in time to stop the virus from being released. Infuse magazine says Sharon Gilbert has a talent for making you feel good, scared, on the edge of your seat, and dying for more. And Christian Fiction Review says Sharon Gilbert does a very nice job of building suspense and horror step by step. The Armageddon Strain from Sharon K. Gilbert, the newest release in the Myth Arc, the ultimate battle for mankind. Available now online and at bookstores everywhere.